Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Hello and welcome back. This is episode 297 of the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. I am Sean Penner, your host. So happy you are joining me today for this best of episode. Today, as you might have seen in the title, we are going to hear and learn from John Finkel, one of the greatest Magic players who have ever played this game. Now, again, as you can see, this is a best of episode, meaning this is an interview that I did in the past, and I'm just replaying it here for you today for several reasons. One, because the show is over 3 years old, and this is actually episode number 2. So we're going way back in the archives, because I'm willing to bet that there are several of you prodigies who have not heard this episode. And with John being the prolific titan of a Magic player that he is, I think it's a great chance to hear what he has to say and to get his story, his origins, and learn more about him. And another reason why we're doing this best of episode is because I am on a Germany trip with my beautiful wife, and scheduling worked out such that we were able to do 2 best of episodes while we were gone. So that's kind of cool. Anyways, as I mentioned, this is pulling back in the archives from episode number 2. Some fun facts. This was actually the first interview that I ever did. So back when I started the show, I had actually connected with Patrick Chapin and invited him to be the first episode. And he graciously agreed, and I thought that was really cool. And then that same night, I met John Finkel, invited him to be on the show, and he said yes. And then when I set up the scheduling appointments for both of them, it turns out that I actually interviewed John Finkel first and Patrick Chapin second. But since I already promised Patrick that he'd be the first episode, I aired that one first. So this is actually the first time I ever sat behind a mic talking with somebody else about Magic. So on my part, it's really rough. Obviously, John is a rock star. He knows his stuff. He's a prolific Magic player, and learning from him is going to be amazing. You're just going to have to deal with rough around the edges old Sean as you get a blast from the past and what it was like for me to run an interview way back then. So I admit it's probably more robotic, a little less animated, but hey, at least the content is there and you get to learn from John Finkel. So thank you so much for bearing with me. It's kind of fun to see a before and after, a then and now, and see how the show has evolved, right? So that's kind of cool. So like I said, today we have John Finkel lined up, and then next week we'll have another best of episode. So thank you so much for your patience, and thank you for allowing me to sneak away with my wife for a couple weeks. And on the topic of thank yous, I'd be remiss if I did not mention the patrons. Thank you so much for your support of the show. And of course, Paragon City Games over at ParagonCityGames.com. They're a wonderful Magic establishment. They are all about community and sportsmanship. They're just the perfect pair to MTG Pro Tutor. I absolutely love being associated with them and encourage you to check them out at ParagonCityGames.com. So with that said, buckle up for this blast from the past best of episode with John Finkel. What's up, everybody? Welcome to the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. I'm Sean Pernod, your host, and today I couldn't be more excited to bring to you our featured guest. Our guest's prolific talents and sterling resume has left a delible footprint on Magic the Gathering's history, as well as inspired players of all ages the world over. After a substantial hiatus, he returned to the Pro Tour and immediately demonstrated why he's widely considered the greatest player of all time by winning Pro Tour Kuala Lumpur in 2008, and top aiding Pro Tour Avacyn Restored and Pro Tour Dark Ascension in 2012. Without further ado, let's welcome Mr. Johnny Magic himself, John Finkel. So John, I shared a little bit about you, but why don't you tell us about you personally and then share what you have going on right now?
Sure. Well, thank you for that very nice intro, and thanks for having me on the show. So I'm John Finkel. I've been playing Magic for well over half my life. I started playing back in antiquities, I guess I was 15, and with maybe a year off here or there, here I am 22 years later in New York City, and Magic is still a huge part of my game, of my life.
Awesome, awesome. So are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience some tips that help them take their game to the next level?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I don't know how much I can really recommend anybody delving into my mind, but yeah, I'll be happy to give whatever little bit of useful information might be able to help people.
Great, thanks. So first off, what do you do for a living?
I'm a trader. I work in finance, which means that I add nothing of value to the world.
Well, no. So have you brought anything from your professional life into how you play Magic, or is Magic like an escape from your professional life?
I enjoy my professional life. you know, we have a small hedge fund. I'm one of the partners there. We have a lot of flexibility. And the modes of thinking, there's definitely, you know, a fair bit of overlap.
Right.
I don't know precisely how I bring anything from work into Magic. Probably argue I bring things from Magic into work.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I don't view Magic as a, you know, as an escape from my professional life. I view it more as just something that I really like to do.
Right, right. Part of a, just part of the whole person concept that makes you you.
Yeah.
Awesome. So John, you've had an amazing journey thus far playing Magic. And what's great about this show is we use stories to close the gap between where our listeners are now and where you are. Because, you know, everyone's like, oh my gosh, it's Johnny Magic. And so we want to help help bridge that gap. So we want to hear a story about your early days in Magic. I'm going to ask you a few questions and give you the opportunity to tell us a story. So you said, you mentioned, first is, when did you start playing Magic? And you said that was back in Antiquities, right?
Yeah, it was, I want to say I played in early 94 is when I started.
Awesome. Yeah, I started in like 98, I think around like Tempest and things like that.
So. Yeah.
Awesome, cool. So what has been your favorite set and why?
In terms of Limited, which I think is generally, at least for me, the way I would think about favorite sets, it's definitely Innistrad.
Okay. Excellent.
It just worked on so many levels. It's definitely, I think, the pinnacle up to this point of their Limited set design.
Sweet. And what's one of your favorite cards? I don't say the favorite card because I know everybody has different cards for different things. So what's one of your favorite cards of all time?
Yeah. I mean, I've never really been that big on favorites.
Okay.
You know, I guess the Storm deck is like I've had a lot of success with.
Okay.
You know, I like, I like Desperate Ravings because it's sort of card that I think plays against some people's impulses. A lot of people are a little bit too risk averse, a little too afraid of randomness.
Okay.
And so I think Desperavians is a good card that maybe is liked less by players than they should. I mean, whenever I see someone with their Storm deck where they took mine and made their own improvements, it's like 50% of the time they took out Desperate Ravings. And I'm just like, I don't think you understand. That card is very good. You know, especially in a deck like Storm where the cards are so replaceable. The one card that's really not is Past and Flames, and that's Flashback. So.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent. Cool. And what makes Magic fun for you?
What makes Magic fun?
Yeah. Like, what keeps you coming back? Like, why do you play?
I mean, Magic's... It's a huge puzzle. I mean, it's arguably, you know, the best game ever made. It's you know, the thing about Magic is that it's a framework that stays pretty much constant, but then all the specifics change. You know, it would be like having a complicated chessboard where every few weeks the pieces you can play with change. Not every few weeks, it's every few months.
Right.
It's you know, Magic, you know, because of this, you know, has so much depth, you know, so much of an ability to add on the kind of core simplicity of it, that it's, yeah, it just never really gets boring. And, you know, fun's an interesting word because people ask me, oh, are Grand Prix fun and are Pro Tours fun? And I feel that fun is not usually the word I would choose to use to describe them, but that isn't to say that I don't find them rewarding or enjoyable.
Right. Okay.
An analogy that I use probably very poorly is, you know, somebody who's, let's say, involved in something like a marathon. You know, around day two of the Pro Tour, it's round 14.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you've been playing and you didn't sleep quite enough and you've been using a ton of mental energy a couple days before preparing, you know, at the site, you know, your food options aren't great and you're pretty exhausted. You're not, you know, it's not like you're like, la-di-da-di-da, I'm going to go play my match. It's going to be such a great time. You know, they can be very stressful events. You know, you're just have like razor sharp focus all the time. And it's what I imagine somebody who's, you know, and in mile 20 of a marathon feels feels like. You ask them, you know, is this fun? And they probably say, well, no, it's not fun.
No, it's not. Like, but, I have run a marathon, yeah. And you're that's a really good analogy, because you're right. Like, in the middle of it, especially towards, you know, the last third or whatever, I'm thinking back on it, and no, it's not fun, but it's one of those things that afterwards you look back and say, wow, like, I'm glad I did it. It was very rewarding. That actually is a really good analogy, because, you know, when you run a marathon, you don't just wake up and run a marathon. Right. There's all that prep work that goes, you know, beforehand, just like all the prep work that goes into making it to big events like GPs and pro tours.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's awesome. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's really cool. And I totally agree with you. I love one thing that I love about Magic is, like you were saying, the game starts before you even sit down across the table from an opponent, right? Because you're building your deck using all these pieces. And like you said, those pieces keep changing every month or every couple of months. So that's, yeah, awesome. Awesome. All right. So tell us a story of an early challenge that you struggled with and how you overcame it. We want to be right there over your shoulder in those early days and learning from you as you leveled up.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to Magic, you know, I lived in England for my first 3 years. I went to a store called Fun and Games. You know, I was one of the better local players, obviously. I'm sure a lot of things that people did poorly, which was, you know, play control-ish decks without enough lands. You know, not always play 60 cards. You know, a lot of those basic mistakes. And then I came to New York. I started playing the Pro Tour. There's a junior Pro Tour then. You know, I had some success. I think my first real breakthrough in terms of changing how I approached the game, she happened after I'd already had some success. It happened in 98. And it was for the Worlds in Seattle, the one that Brian Seldon ended up winning.
Okay.
And one of the blocks there was Wrath Cycle Constructed. That was the kind of Survival of the Fittest, Recurring Nightmare, Tradewind Rider. So I guess Wrath Cycle is what they call Tempest Block. Is that right?
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
And I knew going into it that there was this, you know, Survival, Recur, Living Death deck. They kind of did all the things that I didn't really feel like doing in Magic. You know, I was like, I don't really want to play a stupid deck, but it's going to be there. Everyone's going to play. It's going to be pretty good. Right. They'll probably have a good version.
Right.
And so I went up to Cornell where the rest of the dead guys were. I was playing with them at that point. And maybe, you know, 5 days or whatever. And, you know, I built, okay, the best, you know, deck I could of, you know, the kind of, you know, like the baseline creatures, and it had, you know, 10 silver bullets to go with Survival. And you know, when I play matchups, I try to play both sides of them pretty equally. I think, right, this is also something that's pretty useful. I don't do it 100% of the time, but I think it's something that most people should do more often than they do.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm building this deck and it's just doing well. I'm tuning it here or there, and I just can't find anything that I'm really convinced beats this deck. And eventually I give up. And meanwhile, for the standard portion, we called it Type 2 back then.
Right.
Where, you know, I'd played Forbidian at Nationals. I never thought Forbidian was really a great deck. Nationals... it was a much more important tournament then than it is now, but it was not as important as a Pro Tour. The top prize money was the same, but below that it really wasn't. And I was going to be qualified for Worlds anyway. And Forbidian was a solid deck. It was 50-50-ish against Mono Red. It was really good against White Weenie, which was a popular deck there. It was quite bad against Drago. Although against, like, a non-great Drago player, you can maybe get up to 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm looking at Worlds, and I realize that, you know, Forbidian is not the right deck to play. You know, sure, I ended up making national team with it, although that was in large part because they went 6-0 in the draft.
Okay.
And it was, you know, I played it for fun. So I instead I moved over and played the Dead Guy Red deck, which I thought was just a generally superior deck. And so the tournament shows up, and I'm playing Dead Guy Red in standard, and I'm playing Wrath Cycle Living Death and Block Constructed.
Right.
And these were two decks, and our Wrath Cycle deck ended up being really good. Like it just turned out because I'd played both sides of it, and so that led to doing more tuning of, and so had other people. We had a really good version of it. And I played two decks that were very much against type. I mean, I was known for being a control player. I always liked playing control decks.
Yeah.
And here I was, and I was playing, I guess like a mid-range deck and an aggro deck.
Right.
For me, that's the cool. Important thing was kind of realizing that moving away from my core proclivities was going to make me a better Magic player and have better tournament results. Yeah. Then I played at Pro Tour Paris. I'd played like a bad blue-white control deck in a format where that really was not a good deck at all. I played like a mediocre counterhammer deck, I think like Pro Tour Dallas. I definitely had played control decks when it wasn't really the right time to be playing a control deck. And so I guess the biggest lesson of that is just, to not let yourself get too pigeonholed in one style of deck.
Right.
And one thing I hear a lot from players is, well, okay, maybe this isn't the best deck, but I'll play this deck the best. So for me, this is the best deck choice out of all of the decks.
Yeah,
and
I do hear
I think
too.
That this is a mindset that people use to justify negative expectancy behavior. That that on some level they just want to do, rather than maximizing the results. It might even be true that for a given tournament, playing the control deck that's a 5 might be better for you than playing the mid-range deck that's an 8. But if you have that mindset and you do it all the time, then you're never going to get to the point where you're going to play, these other deck types, because you're always going to argue, well, hey, I'm just better at this, I'm better at these control decks, so of course I'm going to play. I never play those decks.
That's a good point.
So I think that, people need to get out of their comfort zone as far as decks go.
Absolutely. Cool. Thank you. That's great. Thank you for sharing that. So the next quick story we want to hear is your proudest Magic moment to date. Share that with us.
Sure. The moment on the Pro Tour that meant the most to me, it was actually the first top 8 I made in Chicago 1997. The first year of the Pro Tour, I had played on the Junior Pro Tour, the first 3 Pro Tours. I made the quarters of one. I didn't make 2 of another one. And then I lost in the semis of the third. And then I qualified for Worlds on rating because I was one of the top 10 rated players in the world.
Okay.
So I got to play in the senior division because there was no junior Worlds. I came in 9th at Worlds, which got me some invites. The invite system worked a little bit differently. And in the next year, I made 4 top 16s, but I never made a top 8. And then in Chicago 97, I finally made my first top 8, and that really felt like a vindication.
That's awesome.
It felt like I'd worked so hard.
Yeah.
And I always thought I was, really good. Maybe the hubris of youth. I really felt, justified. So definitely that one meant the most to me, the Chicago 97 with my very first top 8. I ended up losing. I beat Olerada in the quarters, and I lost to David Mills in the semis.
Wow. Dang, that's cool. That must be – I can only imagine how that felt. So that's awesome. Thank you. So as we transition from your start as a Magic player – to what you have going on today, I want to touch on your rise to the upper tiers of the Magic community. So you kind of touched on it a little bit, but what did you do to get noticed? Like, what really put you on the map? Was it consistently, I'm assuming it was consistently, you know, top 18 or top 16, all those tournaments?
Yeah. You know, Magic was something of a small community back then. The Pro Tour just started, so people had their local geographic groups.
Okay.
But before that, you would never really know the players from other areas. So you I think there was a lot more kind of intermixing early before people necessarily settled on, you know, the people that they had tended to gel with the best. And people definitely noticed my top 16s. They'd also noticed, you know, I made two junior top 8s. And the junior tournaments then were probably equivalently as hard, as difficult, if not more difficult than the senior ones.
Okay.
It'd be interesting, in fact, if you look back at the very first, let's say, first two Pro Tours, how many Hall of Famers played as a junior and how many played as a senior. I wonder where that would come out at. I know Kai and Steve and Zvi all played juniors, but I'm digressing. So my first top 8 in Chicago, and at that point I was really getting noticed. And then I think it was two Pro Tours later, maybe it was not the next, but two or three Pro Tours later, in early '98. Not sure when exactly. But they, it was maybe about this time of year. I don't know. First half of '98, I win the Pro Tour in New York, the draft Pro Tour, and I think at that point is when people start to think that I might be the, you know, the top Magic player. And then, you know, I made the national team, and followed that up with a top 8 at Worlds, where I lost in the semis. And the U.S. team won the team portion, and at that point, you know, my status was somewhat cemented. So,
yep,
you know, it was a relatively quick, I don't know if ascent's the right word, but you know, I became noticed pretty quickly. But again, it was a different world. I mean, there's far less on the internet about it. You know, there's a lot less noise.
True.
So yeah.
So from your perspective, then, how does one make a name for themselves today in the Magic community that we have now?
I think the best way to do it is just by putting up results.
Yeah.
I mean, writing and other public things help on the margins. You know, maybe you can make a name for yourself as a writer. You know, even if you've never top 8ed a Pro Tour. I know, you know, before Jerry Thompson top 8ed his first Pro Tour, you know, he'd done, I guess, some Star City events. He was known for being a good strategy writer. You know, so he had a well-known name. You know, someone like Michael Flores, who's never top 8ed a Pro Tour and there's a good chance never will, you know, and he's well-known. But most of the people that are known are people who had good performances and have shown themselves to be excellent Magic players. And the writing matters, but that's more of, I guess, like a second-order consideration than a first-order consideration.
Yeah, agreed. Cool. That's great advice, John. Thanks. So let's bring things to present times. So what is your best or favorite format to play?
I mean, I enjoy playing draft. I just find it a lot more fun, a lot more interesting. Constructed can often feel way too much like homework.
Yeah. I just recently got into like standard, and I completely agree.
Yeah.
So what are you doing to stay competitive in draft in that format?
So the way the Pro Tours are structured is that they happen, I guess, about 3 weeks after the set's released. So what I'll do is, you know, maybe I'll do a couple drafts the first week or two. Not always. But luckily I get to play with, you know, a team of, you know, basically the probably the best, you know, Magic team. I mean, I'm biased, but it's also probably true. You know, I think we've called down a little bit smaller for, Vancouver, William Jensen, And I think that we have something like 5 Hall of Famers, 5 Platinum Pros, and then Huey, who's both. And so I show up there, and I draft with them. Maybe we do, maybe I do 8 drafts, and we talk a lot. We have a rundown of the entire format, and it's kind of like a drafting boot camp. Then I'll still do some drafts after that between things. But at that point, it's for a format that's no longer going to be, I'm almost certainly not going to be playing competitively again. I mean, maybe if they have like a local Grand Prix, then that's possible. But so there's not a ton of kind of staying sharp in formats in draft, just because the format's released and then the pro tour happens, and then after that it's like, okay, do whatever you feel like.
Gotcha. So do you have any tips for the mental game, I guess, when it comes to playing?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what people mean by the mental game. I feel it's all a mental game. I think in general, people talk about they mean something like playing at the top of your ability, or recovering from when you make a mistake or when things go against you. Is this what you mean by that?
Yeah. Exactly, keeping calm under stress and catching those mistakes and then recovering from them.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. One of my strengths, I think, has always been that I don't particularly tilt. I feel like I do generally play pretty well. Although when I'm not playing in tournaments, I get pretty lazy. And as I've gone older, that's definitely something that's happened in tournaments as well. But I've always felt that I do a really good job of playing when I'm losing, because moving a 7% chance to win to a 15% chance to win, you're still going to lose a whole bunch. But those are things that really, I think, make a difference in the end. I read a article a while back by this guy Spencer Greenberg, very bright guy. About accepting your error rate, and it's not exactly, it wasn't about magic at all, but the understanding is that there are a lot of things in this world that you believe, that you think, that you're confident of, you try to do, and it's like anything else, it's a probability distribution. And so sometimes you're going to make a mistake. You're going to be wrong. You're going to believe something totally, and it's going to turn out to be the opposite. You're going to, make a play that's either bad for obvious reasons or bad for less obvious reasons that you should have seen. Mm-hmm. And you just have to get comfortable with that. And he's talking there a lot in terms of decisions and other things. And I don't remember if this is exactly what he said. He may not even got into this, but you can definitely cling to a bad idea for longer, because that's what people do.
Right.
No one ever really likes to admit they're wrong, as anyone who's read any internet forums can attest. But when you're trying to make good decisions, and also in magic, that's something that's really important. So you have to accept that, okay, sometimes I'm going to make an error, and try to disassociate your ego from that. I also say that Bob Maher has an ability to more confidently make a mistake than anybody I've ever met in my life. When you're playing a game of Magic, you do something and you're like, and you're immediately like, that was stupid.
Yes.
I just attacked my guy into his guy. He'll just eat it. I don't really have a trick. I have nothing.
Yes.
I can't believe I didn't counter that spell. What was it? I have no idea why I wouldn't. And a lot of times that shows in your face. It doesn't mind. I would not always, but more often than I would like. And a lot of people want to kind of release this tension from, I made a mistake, but saying, but okay, I made a mistake, but at least I realize it. At least I know I screwed up. you know, it chose one way or the other. And this is also problematic. You're compounding a mistake. So, you know, when you realize you made a mistake, just do your best to not give anything away, because sometimes your opponents, especially if they respect you, will say, oh man, like, what the hell is he doing?
Right.
Like, what does he see that I don't see? And you don't want to give them, you know, a freebie and let them off the hook. You know, I've made mistakes where I just made a terrible attack. They've just taken it, and then I've been like, oh God, like, thank God that, you know, that happened. You know, or where I made some attack, and then I'm like, oh, they can just attack back and kill me. And maybe it's like a complicated state, but at least I have all my mana untapped, and, you know, and then they won't, or you know, other things. So, you know, I think that's important, you know, in terms of a mental game is you make a mistake, just suck it up and act like you want to do it. And later on, then you can, you know, be like, Jesus, you know, what the hell is wrong with me?
Sweet. So, let's get down to some nitty-gritties, I guess. Everybody listening desperately wants to improve their game.
Yeah.
Listeners feel that if they lose and they've wasted the time and the money that they spent playing, and of course, no one expects to win every time, but I know what it's like. You know, it's so frustrating to feel like you're playing and playing and playing and you don't improve. So Pro Tutor listeners are asking, how can they actually improve? So we want some actionable advice that we can put into practice the next time, you know, we sit down to play. So let's start with, what's the biggest mistake that you see players make? And then I'll follow that up with, what can we do to avoid that mistake?
Right.
So in your experience, what have you seen the biggest thing, or, you know, just something that pops out that players make a mistake on?
Yeah, this is a good question that I get asked a fair bit, and never really feel fully satisfied with my answer. I mean, I think one of the big things is something I alluded to earlier, which is being very open with, you know, finding and playing the best deck for the tournament, not the deck that you most enjoy playing, and try not to get just stuck in one area. And this can be true for draft as well. You know, the second thing, and I think a lot of Magic players, probably ones who are listening to this, already feel this way, but there's just been playing Magic and then playing Magic with the intention of improving.
Mm-hmm.
So I play, there's another game I play a lot, Dota. You know, it's very similar to League of Legends. And I'm moderately good. I'm maybe a little better than average. But, you know, the group I play with, I'm one of the better people. So that's a little bit, that's honestly great for my improvement. Although there's some people who are better than I am, so that helps. And also, and this is actually else for Magic, is even people that might not be as good at the game as I am would still have useful advice or useful insights that I can use to, you know, to improve my game. So just because, you know, I guess I've used this analogy before, you know, just because, you know, Michael Jordan is, you know, the best basketball player in the world.
Right.
You know, it does mean that he couldn't learn some things about how to shoot a three-pointer from the guy at the end of the bench.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is important to keep in mind. The other thing is playing with the intention of improving. There's interesting just showing up and, you know, playing around with your decks and doing a draft, you know, and obviously getting the reps in will improve your game. But it's different to say, okay, I'm going to be treating all or at least most of these games as, you know, serious endeavors where I'm trying to improve, or I'm going to try different things where I'm going to not fall into my same comfortable patterns. And I think that's really important because it's not just the amount of time that one spends playing Magic. It's you know, the mindset that they bring to those games, and it's the way that they really view the purpose of them as improving as a Magic player and building their skill set and understanding everything, instead of saying, oh, let's jam some more games and, you know, green-white devotion against, I don't know, I don't even know what the standard decks are now, against Grixis, if there is one.
And
I'm not saying that, you know, if they're both, maybe you don't want to prep that matchup if you're playing with those decks, but you know, you also probably want to play a bunch of other things and try a bunch of other things and kind of be looking to improve rather than just have fun.
Right. I think it's important to, like you were saying, make that conscious effort to improve. Like, things like actually writing down, maybe mistakes that you've seen yourself make, or things that you want to focus on the next time you play, really having that intent to, hey, like I want to improve, asking other people who are better than you, who might be, watching your game. That's what I do. Like when I play at my game store, I know the kid that, is probably the best in our store. And so I always ask him, hey, like, what did you see? Like, what could I do? And kind of like, if he was able to watch my match, like a post game roundup type of thing, or go talk to another player who, has similar deck than mine and get advice. And yeah, so making that conscious effort, that's great advice.
Yeah. That's important. If you can get, so you got feedback from people who watched your games, also, getting feedback on things like draft choices. I've never been a big list maker myself. I've never been the type to write down mistakes, mm-hmm. although I definitely think about them and they factor in. I do remember, and I thought it was kind of ridiculous at the time, but maybe it works for him. Back in 2012, I ran well in a couple of pro tours, and I made the that went to 16 person only players championship. I think it was the first one. And this is something that I don't really expect to happen very often, just because I don't play enough Grand Prix to really get those points. While I'm a solid Magic player, I'm definitely not the best of the best at the moment. But Reed Duke was there, and he was somewhat unknown at that point. He qualified, I think, through Magic Online, through their mocks.
Right.
And he had a terrible tournament. He went something like 3-12. I think he played, I don't know if he played that many rounds. I don't know. He had like two or three wins and some large mm-hmm. number of losses. And, he was pretty down on himself.
Yeah.
And I definitely think that you also don't want to be too harsh on yourself. You can definitely separate your, being able to criticize your play and your decisions without making it feel like you're criticizing yourself.
Yourself. That's
but, yeah. But Reed wrote down, man, he comes back the next day and he just has like these like pages of paper of like where he wrote down like every single mistake he made. Some of them I think weren't actually mistakes, but and I still do think it's a little bit ridiculous, but on the other hand, Reed is one of the most intentional players I know, where mm-hmm. it seems like he's trying to get better, think about things all of the time. And, this appears to work for him. And he doesn't seem to be writing down, but just be very cognizant of all the errors you make. Don't sugarcoat them. Don't be like, you can find reasons for why you did something and maybe it wasn't an error, but, be like, yeah, this is a mistake, okay. It doesn't mean I'm a bad person or a bad Magic player.
Right.
Why was it a mistake? What was I thinking? What could I do better? And, even just by thinking about it, it's going to work its way into, your subconscious, your intuitive thought processes that you're making when you're, playing games of Magic in the future. And I think that we can all see, I think Reed is one of the best Magic authors out there as well. So,
Yeah, he's good, yeah.
So maybe he knows something there that I don't.
Well, awesome. Wow, John. I want to acknowledge you for all you've done so far in the multiverse and to thank you for sharing your insights and into the game that we love so much. And we've learned a ton already, and I'm super pumped to hear what you have to say on this last section coming up. All right, John, so let's have a discussion about the lifetime of a set and get your insights on various stages. So first, comes the spoiler. Everybody starts clamoring about what cards are good and which formats, and generally everyone's getting all pumped up. So during the spoiler season, like, what do you do as far as like card evaluation? Do you, do you look at them? How do you evaluate them? Like, what's that error? What's that portion of a new set like for you?
I think I'm more of like a fan than necessarily anything else. Despite what I just said all about Magic, I'm not quite as serious of a player as a lot of players are that are pros right now. I play to have fun. Now, of course, I spent so many years of my life like right. Magic so seriously that these are just baseline thought processes that I do automatically anyway.
Okay.
You know, I've never been super big on constructed or building constructed decks. I do from time to time, but you know, I'm looking at the spoiler. I'm just like curious. I'll see what cards they're making. You know, and yeah. Some of the cards will pop out to me, be like, oh yeah, this is good constructed, that's good constructed. But I'm usually not, you know, when I'm like seeing which ones are on MTG Salvation today that weren't on there yesterday. Okay. I'm not then like writing out, you know, little deck lists on the side. You know, plus Wizards has kind of made that all a bit more obvious. It's like, here are your rares. These are going to be the constructed playable cards. Here are your mythic rares. These are going to be the really, really good constructed playable cards. You know, here's some uncommons. A couple of them will be in decks. Here's commons. Maybe they produce mana and you'll use them. You know?
It's, got it. Yeah. Good point.
So, yeah. So, I mean, but I'm not like, I'm not dissecting every set and, you know, have some big thing in my mind about how each of these cards is going to shift the standard metagame or anything at that level.
What about for limited? Do you kind of comb through it and see, oh, hey, like, here's a good limited strategy or...
I mean, you see what they're what obviously they're going for, and I'll know if I think a card is like good and limited or not. But I don't really get that big into overthinking it until I just start playing with the cards. I've sure. always been very much a learner by doing. You know, one of my partners, he'll make some spreadsheet that we're using. Maybe that I do a lot of implementation. Well, actually less now, but I used to do more implementation. And I still do it, and he does some more research type stuff. Well, he did. Now I do a lot of research, and he does operations. But anyway, that's an aside. He would have some spreadsheet, and he'd make like a couple changes, and then he would write up this like detailed, super long email. And everything in it was relevant, but I felt, but like for me, I always felt like heck, there's like two important things. You just get those at the beginning, and then. These like other details of, you know, why you made this small calculation change choice and then right. like everything else, you know, we don't need to get into all of that, you know, right. right at the beginning. You know, I want to know what I need to know to get this done. And then I can, you know, figure out more by doing and seeing how things play out. So
bluff, right? Bottom line up front.
Yeah. Well, it's not even bluffing. I mean, it's just,
well, yeah, just, you know, bottom line up front. Just tell me what I need to know
yeah.
at the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's just that, you know, we think in somewhat different ways where he's very thorough at the beginning, whereas I like to leave my options and my choices open as long as possible. So right. it also happen, I'll be like, well, what about this thing here? What if this happens and that happens? And this is more from like a business strategy perspective, but, I'll say, well, all right, I mean, this thing over here, this might happen, but these other things that happened before it might never be a problem.
Right.
It might be a problem, but in a way that comes from over here or from over there. I'd rather like why don't we just, you know, assume for now it's not going to be a problem, and you know maybe you know we'll look for these other things that will happen first, and if they happen, then we'll think okay maybe it's a problem, and then we'll have more information to make a good decision a month from now. Then we will write right now. And so to bring that back to Magic, it's similar, you know. I don't just look through the set and I like try everything figured out right then. I'm just gonna play with it and kind of see what comes up is obvious to me. And then think about it a little bit more at that point. I think that there's validity to both thought processes. You know, I know definitely at work that, you know, sometimes there are things we should be planning more for and you make sure it gets it done. And sometimes there are times when we've done enough planning and there's no point in planning out for every scenario when only one of them is going to happen and it might not right. be one of the 10 we planned for.
Right.
So that's how I am with Magic. And then I very much about talking with other people. Maybe I'd read, I might read some articles, except for the fact is that, you know, whatever article that, you know, Huey or Reed is putting up is referencing stuff that I already talked to them about and we developed when we were on house, you know, on site together.
Right. Okay, cool. Yeah. That's awesome. So, All right, so we've evaluated the cards and you know, have an idea of what's good and what's not, things like that. And of course, like you said, we won't really know until we play with the cards. And for many people, the first time they play a new set is in a limited format. It's either sealed at a pre-release or followed up by, you know, a slew of booster drafts. So in sealed, it's generally considered to be a slower format with less powerful decks. Why is that, and how should we use that knowledge in our deck building?
Yeah, for a long time, I always considered sealed to just be a bad version of draft. I find it to be, I still find it to be a significantly less interesting format. I understand logistically why they can't have all drafts at a Grand Prix. Mm-hmm. So sealed tends to be a slower format because people tend to have more bombs, so like the power of their cards tends to be higher because it's never like in a draft where you open up some absurd card and then you get cut off, or you open in pack two or three and you have to take some other card that is playable instead. Right. I mean, obviously in sealed you can open up a bomb rare and not enough that card to play it, but the bombs are so powerful now compared to how they used to be that usually you're going to end up playing them. But on the other side, you're a little bit less likely to get a sort of very focused deck than you might be in draft. Right. You know, a deck with like a perfect mana curve, you know, with all the right tricks and, you know, a bunch of commons and uncommons that are, you know, just kind of doing, doing their job and doing work and maybe not even anything spectacular in it. Okay. In addition to that, the fact that people want to play their bombs, and because it's generally correct to do so, can often tend to lead to decks that are a little bit slower because, you know, someone's like, well, sure, I can build this deck with white in it that, you know, has a pretty good mana curve, it'll come out pretty solidly, but I'd rather just play my black bomb, and the black cards besides that are actually about as good. They don't look, you know, I don't always make two drops, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
So I think that that's probably a lot of the reasons. But again, I mean, I maybe play like two or three sealed decks a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that leads into our next one. So, you know, drafting is considered to be skill intensive and is one of the most popular formats by far. Yeah. And there's several aspects of, you know, draft we'd love to hear your opinions on. So do you have any tips for how to remember what you pass? How do you remember what you pass?
I've always been worse at that than a lot of other people. I mean, I'll remember, if I'm passing, especially in the first pack, because you want to have an idea of what the guy next to you is going to be playing and what you might have coming back. I think that some people will overthink these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the number of times I've seen somebody open up, like, a really good black card and then a good black card and take just like a good red card instead because they don't want to fight.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, it's just so bad. Like, first of all, I mean, sometimes, you know, you take the really good black card and the person next to you took a red card first and it's like, okay, fine, I'll take the slightly worse red card. You know, sometimes they take that black card and then because you're taking black, they don't get to go into it. You know, sometimes they take that black card and they go into black. And then, okay, you know, in your second pack, you know, maybe there are a couple cards you would have gone that don't come your way. But, I mean, that's really all right. that you're giving up there. And it's not even clear if those few picks of somewhat higher quality are going to make the difference between this, you know, really good card that you didn't pass.
Kind of going along with, you know, picking and drafting, things like that. How do you manage your mana curve while you're drafting? I know that online you can see it, but like you're doing an in-person draft, do you just remember how many twos and threes you have, or do you have a little system, or how do you manage your mana curve?
Yeah, so for drafts where you're not allowed to look at your cards between packs, I will take a look.
Right.
I also just have like a pretty vague idea. Not okay. That hard. Like, oh man, I'm picking up a lot of three drops, and I don't really have any two drops. You know, and once you know that there's an area that you're, let's say that you're missing or you're weak on, you'll remember, you'll say, oh man, I only have 1-2 drop and it's halfway through pack two. Like, I definitely need to get some.
Okay.
You know, I mean, do I know if I have 4 or 5 3 drops and 3 or 4 4 drops? I mean, maybe not. But, you know, I think one thing that is probably a reason why I'm pretty good at Magic is that my brain is intuitively pretty good at picking up on what's important. And what that has to do is a lot of, I think, discarding extraneous information. So I maybe don't always remember specifics, but I remember some sort of general feeling. So I mean, I know all my 3 drops, you know, all my 4 drops and how many flyers I have and how many unblockable creatures, but I will know, oh, you know, I'm short on 2 drops, I got a decent number of 3s and 4s, and I have some evasions, so I'm fine there. You know, and
okay.
And I guess that works maybe a little better than going through every card, you know. Or maybe some people just remember every card and then, you know, process that every time they're doing a pick. I don't know.
Gotcha. All right, cool. All right, so the pre-release is over, and we've done some steal, we've done some draft, and big Magic events are usually the next thing, you know, that players go to. Many people go to large events when they feel that they have their feet under them at their local game store. And in order to prepare for these bigger events, you know, I hear a lot about teams and play testing, and you've alluded to this discussion so far. So do you have a team?
For the Pro Tour, I play with the Pantheon.
Okay. And so how crucial is having a team, in your opinion?
I think it's super important.
Okay. So what suggestions do you have for the Pro Tutor listeners in building an effective team? Like, what's that like? What should they look for? Like, let's talk about, you know, teams for a bit.
I think that having a team is just a massive plus. I'm pretty sure that my win rate is higher since 2011 than it was before 2011, and that doesn't even include the Pro Tour that I won in 2008, which was kind of in like Netherland time for me. And I was definitely a better player when I was younger, at least in terms of my in-game play, okay. Both from being younger and also because I played a lot more. And I think that a lot of that just from playing with a team. I mean, I played in so many tournaments with bad decks or I wasn't fully prepared. And now every time I go to a tournament, I always have a really good deck. I always have a good understanding of the draft format from... I mean, I play with, you know, the best players in the world. I mean, I have,
right.
You know, Owen, I have Huey, I have Reed, I have Kunio. Kunio's like, I would say he's underrated, but I think he's starting to get more properly rated. You know, Yelger, who's done great. And then I've even gone to, you know, in fact, like, you know, Kai shows up half the Pro Tours. You know, Nassif, who I think is the 3rd most top 8s. Or maybe it's Palamate's 4th most. I don't know. But also one of the all-time greats, you know, is there. And there's a bunch of other people that, you know, I probably didn't even, you know, mentioned who are all pretty good. I mean, when I show up for my first draft, I'm definitely going to be on the bottom half of people there. And it's very rare that's the case when I sit down at a Magic table.
What should people be looking for when they, you know, put together a team? Like, how do you put together a good team with just, you know, maybe people that you know?
So I think it's important to like each other and to work together well, okay, because you're going to be spending a lot of time with these people. You know, you obviously want to get the best Magic players you can. But it's, you know, it's important to, I think one of the underrated things about teammates are you want people who don't get emotionally attached to their decks, don't have huge egos about them, because that can be a negative. I mean, we all get attached to decks we build to some extent and decks we play, but you want to minimize that. You want people that are willing to try different things. You want people who are going to be serious about it. You want people that will be logistically convenient to play with. You know, if you're trying to prepare for, you know, PPTQs and you know, local events, well, it's probably good to have people that are, you know, nearby or that, you know, you can play with online conveniently. You know, having a teammate in California, a bunch of teammates in California, is not going to be as useful when you then have to go to your store in New Jersey and play against other people.
Right. All right, cool. So then as we move into the home stretch here, one, I guess, question on improvement is, what do you suggest for people, like maybe beginning players who have a limited budget and they can't afford to, you know, draft every day on online or construct the new and most popular deck? Like, how can those people improve? Like, what do you suggest for those entry-level players?
Right. So they do have draft simulators online, which help. You can also, if you have some of your friends, I mean, I've done this before. Generally, when new sets come out, you don't have the product where you can, you know, rebuild packs. They won't have the exact same collation, but it still helps.
That's really good advice.
You can definitely proxy up packs and proxy up decks. You know, I mean, it's a lot harder for this sort of player who doesn't really have access to, like, every deck. You know, although, you know, begging and borrowing can help.
And scraping, yeah.
Okay. You know, so for them, they might have to, you know, choose a deck type to kind of specialize in and have to hope that it's good or they can borrow for any format. That would probably be the one area where it's the biggest difference, where they have to, where they're basically going to just try to have effectively one deck built instead of having, you know, the ability, if they really wanted to build a number of different decks.
Gotcha. And do you have a Magic-related resource that you like to share with the listeners?
I don't, you know. I mean, obviously you can read all the articles online and things like that, but I probably know less about the various Magic resources available than the average listener.
No worries. So as we start to wrap things up, we're all dying to know what your plans are for the future. Do you have any machinations of grandeur for upcoming Pro Tours?
I mean, I think we go to Pro Tours. I mean, grandeur is going to be a... there's going to be a large luck component to that. You know, I have to get pretty lucky to do well. I mean, so is everybody.
Okay.
But yeah, I plan going to, you know, Pro Tours for, you know, the foreseeable future.
Excellent. Yep. That's awesome. That's awesome. Now, finally, what's the best way that we can connect with you? And then what's one parting piece of guidance that you can leave with our listeners for the next time that they sit down to play?
Sure. The best way to communicate with me is probably just via Twitter. I'll generally at least read it and, you know, try to respond if it, you know, if it makes sense. You know, I can't promise to be 100%, but I'll generally try.
No worries. And we'll have your Twitter handle in the show notes. So we'll have that there. And then what's one parting piece of guidance that they can put into action when they sit down?
Yeah, I mean, so it's core, I guess Magic is, you know, you have to realize it's a very difficult game. You know, I think that the most important thing is to keep the balance between being very critical of your play and always looking to improve, but not being so critical that it impacts your play negatively and makes you play worse.
All right. Well, thank you so much, John, for your time and for sharing your expertise. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it's been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed, always draw what you need, and depart every plane victorious.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thank you again for tuning in to episode 297 and getting this blast from the past episode, this best of with John Finkel. I hope you enjoyed it. Hope you learned as much as I did. Listening to this again really reminded me of how great John is and what a wonderful guy. So it was so awesome to connect with him, and I definitely hope that you learned, if nothing else, a little bit about John and his origins and what it was like to play Magic in his day. So he still makes top 8 of Grand Prix every now and again and top 16 of Pro Tours. He is a rock star for sure. So anyways, you can get the show notes over to mtgprotutor.com/John Finkel Best Of. That's John Finkel Best Of. That's where you can find the show notes for today's episode. And with that, my friends, I will take my parting. Enjoy your week. I cannot wait to connect with you again next week. And until then, you know I'm Sean of the Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.